Chapter 94, War and Victory. We have gradually drawn near to the 80-year struggle of Netherlands fathers against the Roman Catholic tyranny. No, this was not a revolutionary war, but a faith's conflict. That is denied by some writers, but they distort that country's nice national history. We could mention many instances to prove that it was really a faith's conflict, yet we shall not do that because that would carry us too far. We shall give only a few very clear proofs, and they are amply sufficient. Let us just read what Alva himself wrote to King Philip II after he had been active for some time in that country. Then he has written a long letter to his king. Naturally, we shall not rewrite that entire letter here. Only one sentence, but that tells us enough. Then he wrote, "Yet the Dutch people are so patient that whenever the king puts an end to that bloody domination, for which it is not yet the time at present, and shall proclaim a general pardon, then that people shall incline itself to obedience, just as easy as it now shows itself unruly." This sentence speaks clearly enough, does it not? Let us mention another instance. When Alva had already departed from the Netherlands, it was told in Spain that the high taxes and the cruel oppression by the Spanish soldiers had caused the people of the Netherlands to rebel. Alva then wrote another letter to the king, in which he explained the true cause of the rebellion, and he was in a position to know, because he had sojourned long enough in the Netherlands. In that second letter it reads, "Not the money, and not the military, but religion alone is the cause of the rebellion. And if no freedom of conscience is granted to the rebels, then they shall never subject themselves." I should think that this language is clear enough. Alva realized very well why the Dutch people offered such a desperate resistance. It was religion alone. Hence, what was the object? Not resistance to the authority, because then it would have been revolution, but to obtain liberty to be permitted to serve God, such as he has commanded in his word. And in order to oppose that with force, that blood management was employed. As we already observed, the man who wrote this was Alva himself, the Iron Duke, who has tried with unscrupulous cruelty to subject the Dutch heretics. From these mentioned letters, it is clear that the 80 Years' War was not a revolutionary war, such as Rome alleged at one time. May we then briefly repeat that which we wrote at the end of the previous chapter? After Haarlem had fallen, someone wrote to the Prince of Orange, "Now it is lost unless you have made an alliance with one or another powerful ruler." To this, William of Orange answered, and we shall tell you in plain words, "Before we came to the assistance of the oppressed people of the Netherlands, we have made a firm covenant with the potentate of all potentates, thus with God, and I am fully assured that we and all those that firmly trust in that shall finally be delivered by his powerful and mighty hand, in spite of all his and our enemies." From this, it is clearly evident that it was a faith's conflict. The fathers of that people have offered property and blood for the cause of liberty. God himself has been pleased to crown that faith's conflict with a favorable issue. How often has the Lord manifested his favor toward that people? You realize that we are not going to discuss the entire 80 years war, because that really belongs to the national history. It is true they are nice stories, beautiful histories, but to tell them in detail is not the object of this church history. We shall tell you something about it because church history and national history are so closely connected with each other. Thus, Alva ruled in poor Netherlands. Alva, the Iron Duke, cruel and pitiless. He was a zealous Roman Catholic, and according to him, all means were lawful to maintain the authority of the Roman Catholic Church in that country. One of his first acts was to establish the Council of Tumults. That council had to put an end to all the tumults in that country. In the beginning, he himself was the chairman of that council. That Council of Tumults began its work with unmerciful cruelty. Thousands of death sentences have been pronounced by the members of that council. The people soon had thought of another name for that Council of Tumults. They called it the Council of Blood, and that name fit exactly. How much innocent blood has been shed by that council. Alva would have liked it very much to get the Prince of Orange in his power, but he did not succeed in that. The Prince of Orange had fled to Germany and was safely lodged in his ancestral castle, the Dillenburg. Alva has tried with friendly letters to lure the prince to the Netherlands. Orange would have nothing to fear, and he would very much like to cooperate with him and much more of that rubbish. And he did this while he had the death warrant of the prince in his pocket. How intensely base, isn't that so? When he did not succeed in that, he had Egmont and Horn arrested, and those two noblemen were beheaded in 1568 at Brussels. Egmont had not deserved that at the hand of his king, because he had served him faithfully, yea, too faithfully. Egmont had been judged by the judge of heaven and earth as being a persecutor of the people of the Lord, as a man whose hands dripped with the blood of the children of God. But of Philip II and Alva, this condemning and putting to death of Egmont was a shameful act. All the people in the Netherlands know the history of the beginning of that struggle. Just think of the battles at Heiligerlee and Hemmingen. In the Battle of Heiligerlee, Adolf, the youngest brother of the prince, was killed, and he gave his young life for the cause of liberty. That entire campaign of the prince failed completely. God's ways are higher than our ways, and are often incomprehensible to us. But when everything seemed to be lost, and deliverance seemed to belong to the impossibility, then God arose and granted deliverance. God usually works through the impossible. How often has the Lord used weather and wind to save the Netherlands out of great distress? Or was the northwestern storm which brought the sea beggars before Brielle accidental? Don't you think that the storm was ordered by God? And what about the storms at the siege of Leiden? First, a northwestern storm which forced the sea water high up against the coast, and after that, a southwestern storm which brought the inrushing waters as far as the walls of Leiden, which no one had counted on. Has all that happened, perhaps, accidentally? In all these things, we must observe the powerful hand of God and behold his miracles. Are we able to relate all of God's wonders? That is impossible, for then it would become too extensive. Just read for yourself the miracles of the Most High and other works of the national history. Who of Netherlands inhabitants does not know the wonderful story of the Armada, which had been proudly called the Invincible Armada by the Spaniards? That powerful fleet has been smashed apart upon the coasts of Scotland by heavy storms, which had been decreed by God. We all know the saying, destroyed by the breath of God, do we not? God has also intervened with other accidentals. Then we think of what happened at the capture of Wesel in 1629, when the stadtholder Frederick Henry was besieging Hertogenbosch. The first bullet shot by the Spaniards at the Dutch soldiers hit the chain of the drawbridge, which just would not go down. That first bullet shot that heavy chain to pieces, so that the drawbridge plunged down, and the Dutch soldiers could march into the city of Wesel. When the messenger brought the tidings of this to Frederick Henry, he said to him, "Oh, my son, did it happen that way? Then it was a work of God and not of man." Did not the Spaniards themselves exclaim, "Weather and wind are the soldiers of the beggars"? That was a testimony of the enemy. At times the cause of liberty was in a sad plight, because that struggle has not been easy. Prosperity and adversity succeeded each other. Victories and defeats alternated with each other. At times the distress rose very high, so that everything seemed lost. But then the Lord gave unexpected deliverance, so that all at once everything changed. When the Spaniards had severed Holland and Zeeland from each other by the conquest of Schouwen and Duiveland, which caused great dejection to prevail in that country, and the situation became very dangerous, the Spanish governor, Requesens, died suddenly, by which the threat was averted. The Spanish troops went into mutiny and entirely on their own accord left the islands, which had been conquered at the cost of so much blood. Indeed, it is no wonder that the enemy exclaimed, "God has become beggar." When in 1584 the Prince of Orange, who had received the honorable name of Father of the Country, collapsed and died, having been cut down by the hands of a murderer, Spain and Rome rejoiced, because they counted on it that the struggle would soon be finished. The prince was dead, was he not? But they rejoiced too soon, because God was not dead. He was still alive. Others continued the work of Father William. Who does not know the names of Morris and Frederick Henry? And when finally in 1648 the Peace of Westphalia was concluded, the Netherlands were completely independent from Spain. Who would ever have imagined that? That little country, the Netherlands, had joined battle with the world empire of Spain and had gained a victory. During the war, the Netherlands had become rich and powerful, while wealthy Spain had become impoverished and no longer counted among the family of nations. Indeed, if the Almighty had not assisted them, then they would have perished long ago. That history is replete with the wonders of God. This part is really national history, but because it is so closely connected with the history of the Church of the Lord, we have mentioned something of it. We may really say that it is a miracle of God's omnipotence, and that they have victoriously emerged from that seemingly desperate struggle. God, the Lord, reigns. Let us now return to the history of the Church. It is a miracle of God that the Church in that country in those dark days of persecution was not destroyed. However much persecuted and oppressed, the various congregations continued to exist. That came about indirectly because consistories had been chosen over the congregations who governed those congregations. We have already told you before that next to the Alliance of the Nobles in 1566, there existed also an Alliance of Consistories. When the Alliance of Nobles was dissolved due to the iconoclasm, the Alliance of the Consistories continued to exist. Yet outside of that, those consistories were detached from each other, and it was necessary that there came unity. It was necessary that the various consistories began to support each other. The man who especially urged unity and cooperation was Marnix of St. Aldegonda. He descended from an ancient noble family and was born in Brussels. First, he studied at Louvain, and later at the university in Geneva, where Calvin and his successor Theodore Beza were his teachers. He joined himself to the Calvinists and has become a man of great influence. He was present at the presentation of the petition, and according to some writers, he was the man who had urged that. When Alva came as Orange, he fled to Germany. He formed a friendship with Orange and has been his great co-worker. In 1573, he was made prisoner by his enemies, but Orange succeeded to exchange him for Bossu, who in the Battle of Zuiderzee had been made prisoner by the Dutch. According to all probability, he was the poet of the Dutch national anthem Wilhelmus. He has also rhymed the Psalms, but these have never been accepted by the churches, hence they were not generally introduced. The psalm rhyming of Dataine, the so-called old rhyme, was too well liked by the people. After the Prince of Orange had been murdered, and his son Maurice continued with the work of his father, the friendship between the House of Orange and Marnix of St. Aldegonda continued to exist. Marnix of St. Aldegonda was a great linguist. For that reason, the government of that country, the States, asked him to translate into the Dutch language the Bible from the original languages in which God's Word was written. That was a tremendous task. He has assumed that honorable commission, and full of courage, he began to work on that. Alas, he was constantly delayed by other activities. He finished the translation of the first book of the Bible, Genesis, but when he wanted to commence with Exodus, he suddenly died in the year 1598. Well then, this Marnix of St. Aldegonda realized very well that unity and cooperation upon ecclesiastical terrain was necessary, otherwise the danger threatened that confusion and discord would prevail. Two kinds of congregations existed. The first group were the refugee congregations. They originated by people who had fled for their life to safer regions. Having arrived there, they looked for each other and founded a congregation. We have already told you that Calvin, after his departure from Geneva, was for some years preacher of a French refugee congregation at Strasbourg. Also, John Knox, the great reformer of Scotland, has for some time served an English refugee congregation, which had been founded in the German city of Frankfurt on Main. In Germany, there were also numerous Dutch refugee congregations. The second group were the Churches Under the Cross. They met and held their religious services in the place of their residence in the midst of the most violent persecutions. Danger threatened everywhere. Death lurked everywhere. But they persevered. Through betrayal and other circumstances, members were constantly made prisoners and after the severest tortures were publicly or also secretly put to death. But those that were left did not flee, but they remained at their post and continued the work. Hence it is no wonder that these churches received the byname of Under the Cross. At times, these two groups of churches corresponded with each other. Also, at times, the churches under the cross mutually asked each other for advice. But it was very difficult. It was not so easy to support each other and to help with word and deed. Hence, it happened that usually in difficult cases, every congregation decided for itself what was best. Now it was Marnix of St. Aldegonde who visited various preachers or wrote them to meet at a certain place and to discuss the state of affairs. Naturally, that meeting could not be held in the Netherlands because due to the raging of Alva, that was absolutely impossible. For that reason, the German city of Wesel was designated as the place to meet. Indeed, in the year 1568, such a conference took place in Wesel. No, it was not a synod, a lawful ecclesiastical meeting, because those that were present had not been delegated by the churches. Every attendant came personally, without having been sent by his church. For that reason, we do not speak of the synod at Wesel, but the convention at Wesel. Yet this convention has been very important. Peter de Tanis, the well-known field preacher and the man of the old rhymed version of Psalms, undoubtedly was the chairman of that meeting. At that convention at Wesel, they have discussed a church order with each other. There must be order. Where no order prevails, there arises disorder. That is so in society, and that is also thus in the church. A church where no order prevails is ruined after a shorter or longer period. There they have spoken about the administration of the church. They have discussed how they must act in certain specific cases. How necessary it is that unity prevails with respect to this. They have discussed the creed, that means the doctrine. They could not make decisions because they were not lawfully delegated, but yet there in Wesel the foundation has been laid for the administration of the churches. And when they returned home, they told their congregations what had been discussed there, and they have asked if the consistories would act according to that which had been proposed and discussed at the convention at Wesel. Such a meeting must be held again, thought Marnix of St. Aldegonde, and he went to work again. But then it must be different than before. The consistories of the congregations must now delegate particular persons from their midst to go there. This second meeting would therefore have to become a lawful ecclesiastical meeting, which would have the power to make decisions. The French, German, English, and Dutch churches were invited to participate in this meeting. They were kindly invited to send delegates who would represent those churches by whom they were delegated. This time, the German city of Emden was designated as the place of assembly. Thus, in October 1571, the first synod met at Emden. They had chosen a suitable time for that. It was just the annual fair at Emden. A social bustle prevailed in that city. The people traveled from the entire surroundings to the festival city. In such an overwhelming bustle, who would pay any attention to a few strangers that came into that city? Indeed, no one. So many strangers came daily into the city. Nothing could be noticed on them whether they were visitors to the annual fair or that they came for another reason. Thus, unnoticed and without causing suspicion, the synod could convene. No, it was not a large synod. The times were too difficult for that. Traveling was too dangerous for that, especially for the delegates. There were only 29 delegates present from the various churches. But again, the great difference with the meeting of Wesel 3 years ago was that these people had been delegated by their churches. Hence, they represented their churches, and that was of great importance. There were French, German, and Dutch delegates. The English church had also been invited, but had not sent representatives. Pitiful. This Synod of Emden has been very important. Naturally, there they spoke about the doctrine and about the confession. The Heidelberg Catechism, which had been drafted by Caspar Olivianus and Zacharias Ursinus, and the Catechism of Geneva were both approved. The Netherlands Confession of Faith, drafted by Guido de Bray, was subscribed to by all. A church order, in which the most important matters were determined, has been drafted there also. In the Roman Catholic Church, the hierarchy rules. That means that the Pope of Rome rules over the entire Roman Catholic Church. But there would be no lordship in the Reformed churches. The one congregation was not permitted to rule over the other. The one preacher was not permitted to lord it over another preacher. It made absolutely no difference whether they served a large congregation or a small congregation. How wise our fathers have been, because how great is the danger that a preacher of a large congregation begins to exalt himself. That little devil of pride is far from being dead. Thus it started in the Roman Catholic Church, isn't that so? Do we still remember that? Bishops, archbishops, patriarchs, etc. The men of the Reformation have been on the guard that no repetition would take place. But still more decisions were made at that Synod of Emden. Various congregations who were close to each other would together form a classis, which must be called together every 3 or 6 months. Then the delegates of those congregations would meet together. Provincial synods would also come, which would be called together once a year. And once every 2 years, a general synod would meet. In that way, the consistories of the various congregations in larger or smaller connection could hold conferences. The church order, which was drawn up at that time, is still, for the greatest part, in force today. It is true, some trifling matters have been changed, but the greatest part has been maintained up till the present day. We all know that even now, from time to time, classical meetings are held. We also read in the newspapers in the Netherlands that various churches there come together in synodical meetings. This was not an easy portion, but we must also know something about these matters. For that reason, we have told you this as briefly and as simply as possible. To be sure, much more could be told about that, but then it would become too difficult, and that is not our intention. Also in this we notice clearly the golden thread of God's reign. God himself has watched over his church so that it did not perish in those dark days. In spite of the bloody persecutions and the daily perils of life in which they were, God has given those people courage and strength to persevere. He gave them a desire to travel to Emden, to there discuss the interest of the congregations with each other. You may surely believe that they have prayed to the Lord for relief and deliverance out of that great distress in which they were. And God did give deliverance. Those prayers have been answered. Several months later, in April 1572, the sea beggars took Brielle. Ah, perhaps many have shaken their head and thought, that shall come to naught. That shall end in a failure again. All attempts to help the Netherlands had failed, had they not? Alva thought the same thing about that, because he said scornfully, no es nada. That means, it is nothing. But he did not say that several months later, for shortly after that, the people revolted against the Spanish tyranny. Many cities drove the Spanish soldiers away and declared themselves in favor of the prince. 3 years later, the next synod was held on Dutch soil at Dordrecht. Also, in the years after that, the synods were held in Dutch territory, where they could meet quietly and undisturbed. Who could have dared to hope for that? We must tell you one more important event. Young men who wanted to study for the ministry always had to go abroad, because that is where the universities were. Then they studied at the University of Wittenberg, and especially at the University of Geneva. But in 1575, the Netherlands received its own university. It is known from the national history that in 1574, Leiden was being besieged. Although the famine became constantly worse in the city, and as a result of that the pestilence took hundreds of victims, yet the people held out. But when the distress had reached its extreme height, then God granted deliverance. Fierce storms drove the water to and before Leiden's walls, so that the besiegers were forced to break up the siege and Leiden was released from its sufferings. Although the pestilence still raged, yet the Prince of Orange visited the city. He wanted to shake the hand of those brave defenders. As a reward for their brave endurance, the prince in 1575 granted a university to Leiden. From now on, the future preachers need no longer go to Geneva to study, but they could remain in the Netherlands and pursue their studies in Leiden. We could relate many more narratives. The founding of the Union of Utrecht in 1579 by John the Old, a brother of the prince, has also been an act of far-reaching consequences. Likewise, the renunciation of King Philip II of Spain, by which the bond which united the Netherlands with Spain was permanently broken. This renunciation was no act of revolt, but of obedience to God's commands. The object of those fathers was not to oppose themselves to the authority, but they would and could no longer acknowledge the crowned murderer as their lawful ruler. They never would have renounced Philip II if he had given that people liberty to serve God according to his own laws and institutions. Just to employ the words of Alva once more, it was religion alone which drove them to that act. But since this belongs in the sphere of the national history, we shall stop with that. However, from this chapter it is clearly evident that the Lord has been pleased to crown with his blessing the labor and the struggle of those fathers. The attempts of the Roman Catholic Church to extinguish the light of the Reformation in the Netherlands has completely failed. What a great defeat that was for the Prince of Darkness. The bloody sacrifices have not been made in vain, because even now they shall still reap the fruits of that struggle and faith's courage. Is that so dearly obtained liberty still realized and appreciated? The increasing indifference proves the opposite. Has God so often helped them for that in such a marvelous way? What shall we answer him when he shall call us to give an account?